is greatly worried all across the fruited plain. Worried about what? About inflation. Because there are some people, I mean, they're now older voters, but there's some people who remember 1980, where the inflation rate was more than 13%. Can you imagine? It's about double what it is now, but what it is now is more than double what it was just a couple of years ago. And what does inflation rate matter? Well, it can actually make or break presidencies. Who knows about that? Jeff Greenfield. Jeff has been a longtime political commentator and a political strategist and aide. He's a five-time Emmy-winning network television analyst and author. And Jeff's new piece is about Biden's empty inflation toolbox. And I think what you're saying here that's very important is that there is really no basis for expecting that Joe Biden or any president could really do that much about a rising rate of inflation. Are there some exceptions to that, things that he could do that could be helpful to his cause?
Well, you know, once inflation raises its ugly head, there is you can almost call it a tropism, an impulse for it to do something about it. And we've seen presidents, I mean, Richard Nixon, a one-time conservative, imposed wage price controls in 1971 for 90 days, which is like stuffing a rag into a pipe that's leaking. I mean, eventually you take the rag out and it leaks. You probably remember Gerald Ford's PR campaign to, quote, whip inflation now with win buttons, asking Americans to send in ideas. You know, presidents are often tempted when energy is an issue, which it was in 73 and 79 and now. Well, we have a strategic petroleum reserve we could drain. That's literally almost a drop in the bucket or a cup of coffee poured into the ocean. We've had one example, and it isn't a president. It's an unelected government official who actually beat inflation, and that's Paul Volcker, who, as chair of the Federal Reserve, when he was appointed in 1979, began to ratchet up interest rates, dry up credit. At one point, the interest rate, the prime interest rate, was over 20%. What did it do? It caused the biggest recession since the Great Depression. That probably helped Carter lose in a landslide to Reagan. And once inflation was drained, and the economy began to recover, Reagan won in 1984, 49 states. And the key, and you alluded to it, Michael, is we haven't had anything like hyperinflation in the 40 years since. So 6% might not have, it would have been a relief in 1981 from those high numbers. But compared to what we've had, it seems really bothersome and scary. And you know, voters or citizens get their information about inflation at the gas pump, at the checkout counter, when they pay a home heating bill, or when they try to buy a car. And those pieces of information don't come with explanations. You know, they don't say, well, you can't really blame Jimmy Carter for the oil embargo, or you can't really blame Joe Biden for a choke, you know, a supply chain for the absence of thousands of truckers, but we do. We always do, and that's what presidents have to deal with.
You know, it's interesting right now because if you were part of the Biden high command, if there is such a thing, if he's sitting down with Ron Klain and his economic advisors and others, isn't it possible, because I've heard some fairly high-level speculation about this, that he would rather have inflation bothering people right now and maybe even harming the Democratic cause in Congress, for control of Congress in 2022, where everybody's talking about a potential Republican wave. He'd rather have that and then use the next 2 years to make it look better than to actually do something right now. In other words, well, that right now there's time for people to let the sting go away before 2024. But it looks like it's going to be terribly timed for Biden.
Sorry, I'm talking over you.
No, no.
If you believe some of the high-powered financial wizards at Goldman Sachs and other firms, they think that inflation will substantially dissipate or ease sometime next year. So it may be that by 2022, if inflation eases early enough next year, that voters will have a very different view of this. It's certainly true that Reagan experienced what you went through, what you described. The Republican Party lost, I think, 28 House seats in 1982. Unemployment then was 10% because of that Paul Volcker recession. But by 84, it had recovered. And the problem is that I see two political problems here. One is that the White House was saying back in July that disinflation was transitory. It was just coming out of a pandemic. Well, we're now in November, so I don't know what transitory means. And the second thing is you had two prominent Democrats who served Bill Clinton in the economic team, Larry Summers, who was Treasury Secretary, and Steve Rattner, who worked under him, who said back last year that this massive infusion of cash into the bank accounts of almost every American could have an inflationary impact. And so that's, one of those old schoolyard ballgame things. Your own man said so. It's interesting to me also that the inflation fear, I think, is going to make it even tougher to pass Biden's ambitious social spending agenda, because it gives people like Joe Manchin and Kirsten Sinema a reason to say, wait a minute, we've got inflation now. Why don't we just not do this? Which would have huge political impact. So I guess what it all comes down to, Michael, is, when inflation is present, it's time for the president and his team to reach for the Advil.
Yeah, there's obviously a lot to worry about, but what killed Carter, and you allude to this in your column, was what they called stagflation. It was that there was both high unemployment. We had, 10% unemployment rate? And at the same time that you had a 13% interest rate. I mean, it was disastrous. And it's that that is most dangerous, isn't it? But the economic experts say we don't have to dread that, at least not right now.
Yeah, and I think you're talking about a particular period when the tight money policy was hitting, around 1980, unfortunately for Carter, the election. So your inflation hadn't yet begun to wither under the Volcker policy, but unemployment was beginning to ratchet up as employers saw and investors saw the credit markets tightening. So that was also a case of really bad timing. And you can find a lot of people who think there are things that the president can do, and it largely comes down to their policy preferences. There's still some quotas or tariffs on imported material. Maybe they should be removed. That would drive prices down. But the evidence seems to be that by and large, what has triggered, particularly what's triggered disinflation, is just a kind of a series of events, not the least of which is you do have a nation of citizens with a lot of cash on their hands, and until recently, not a lot to use it on. So you've got people who, the demand for new cars would have been high anyway. Then you've got this microchip shortage, which is preventing thousands of new cars from being built, and that's driving up the cost of used cars.
This is all so complicated, and it is amazing, and the historical perspective is essential. Take a look at Jeff Greenfield's column from Politico magazine. It's at our website at michaelmedved.com. We'll be right back. And on the Michael Medved Show, I do think that when you talk about political commentary and trying to make sense of the inflation problem and the corporate supply chain problem and all of these difficulties that are confronting the Biden administration right now. The reason it's so terrible for Biden is because he had already established, because of the Afghanistan withdrawal, that he wasn't a particularly good administrator. He didn't have a focus or particularly lucid thinking, sometimes not even particularly coherent thinking. And when all of a sudden you're facing complex issues like that, it's tough to imagine Joe Biden getting better at this point. That was the whole idea of Build Back Better, was that there would be a sense of improvement in the country. And right now, with almost three-quarters of Americans thinking we're headed in the wrong direction, we're not going that way. I'll tell you somebody who I think is going in the right direction, and it's pretty amazing, because this is somebody who once upon a time was a very big, prominent liberal. He was on with Chris Cuomo on his show on CNN, was Bill Maher. And once upon a time, he gave $1 million to Barack Obama's campaign. And I think that's significant and notable, because what it indicates is he's not just taking the political opinions he takes to try to make good material for his shows. He actually believes in some of the political ideas that he advocates, including those that are increasingly conservative, and actually bracing and encouraging to hear them expressed by somebody from the left, like Bill Maher. For instance, one of the things he said to Chris Cuomo is he specified what it is that is killing the Democratic Party. This is clip six.
Woke. The response from the people that you put it on will say no. Woke is aware and inclusive. And there is no cancel culture. It's just accountability. These are not bad things. They are good things. Disagree.
In its best sense, if we're talking about being aware of things that we always should have been aware of more, reckonings that we've had with sexual malfeasance, with racial injustice, that's all a good thing. But there's a reason why the term woke has come to signify going too far and doing things that don't make sense. I keep saying this to the Democratic Party. The reason why you are so toxic is because you have become the party of no common sense.
Okay, and common sense is a precious commodity. By the way, I remember a campaign. It was actually a campaign. I was working for the guy opposing the one who used this slogan. In 1970, there was a guy named Al Donahue who was running for Senate in Connecticut, and he had TV ads, tons of them. He was a very wealthy guy. He had Zipper manufactured zippers. He was a zipper king. In any event, Al Donahue had this slogan: finally, somebody's beginning to make sense. And sounds like it should be a pretty good slogan. Didn't work for Al Donahue. But making sense? Yeah, making sense involves telling the truth. And Bill Maher and Chris Cuomo actually admit a fundamental truth that most liberals will deny. Listen, this is clip five.
So it's that you have families, and we saw this resonate in Virginia. And I have people on all the time who reject this premise, but we just saw it play out, so it must be real to a lot of people, which is you want to make white kids feel badly about what happened before them, and that their lives should be a function of making up for it. And I don't want that put on my kid.
Yes, kids are taught, and sometimes separated into groups, oppressor and oppressed. Again, does a kid even know what those words mean? Would they gravitate toward that if you hadn't told them? I mean, you're taking something that was getting better, race relations in America, and I think everyone recognizes, everyone right-thinking in my view, that still a lot of work needs to be done. Remedial efforts need to be taken still. Racism is part of America. But I did a thing one night about progressophobia, which is a term Steven Pinker called, coined, which means somehow liberals got afraid to acknowledge progress. You know, it's two thoughts in your head at the same time. You can acknowledge that we have made great progress on all the social issues, and yet there is still more work to be done.
Okay, and then this about double standards in media coverage. There's a lot you can say about this, but this is an important point. This is clip 9.
Something like Hunter Biden. I mean, if Don Jr. had done what Hunter Biden had done, it would be every night, all night on MSNBC. But the fact that it's Hunter Biden and Joe's on the blue team, see, that's the problem with America. Everything is so binary. Everything that the red team doesn't like goes in the blue bin and vice versa. So, you know, every Democratic politician has to wear on his sleeve every silly, stupid, woke thing that the fringe left does. And the red team has to wear kids in cages and, you know, lock her up and all that kind of stuff.
Okay, and again, that's part of what came across in that Paul Gosar blowout yesterday. It's one of those things where when he was talking about making sense, it's a very, very easy question to actually put it to even the most committed liberal. Do you really believe that Paul Gosar is sending out this stupid, crudely drawn, idiotic cartoon that is showing him as a sort of a superhero combating the immigration issue by waving swords at President Biden? Do you really think somebody's going to see that and say, oh, I want to be that guy? This is going to lead me to commit violence. This is actually going to inspire crimes. Now, I for years and years, I've written books about the fact that, yes, violent imagery, when it's very realistic, can help convince people that it's a cruel world, it's a mean world, and violence is acceptable. But that wasn't this. So what are you wasting your time for with a censure in the midst of that? And why can't Republicans just admit, Gosar, you blew it. You did something you shouldn't have done. Cancel the video. Don't have it up anywhere. Don't try to blame your staff. Just say a terrible mistake was made and you regret it. And then maybe go on to actually dealing with some of the nation's real problems. 1-800-955-1776. There's a Democrat, prominent one, who says Joe Biden isn't helping the middle class, he's helping the rich. Why? We'll get to that coming up on the MedVet Show. And on the Michael Medved Show, you are now hearing, believe it or not, voices from the left that are attacking other people on the left, like the President of the United States. And I do believe he is governed not like someone in the center, but like someone from the left wing of his party. That there are people who are even more left-leaning than Joe Biden who are attacking the President of the United States and the Democratic Party for doing a massive tax cut for the rich. Now what is this? Have they figured out this is a way to get more equality in terms of the distribution of wealth in this country? Not at all. Because the tax cuts for the rich that Biden is talking about are deliberately political. What all of this is about is salt. Salt is the state and local taxes. And the question is that if you allow wealthy people to deduct state and local taxes, and when it comes to state and local income taxes, the people who deduct get most of the money for deductions are the people who are earning a great deal of money, who are paying a great deal in state and local taxes, And then if you can subtract that from your federal income taxes, it can be a tremendous amount of money. And this has gotten to become a matter of very substantial concern for people on the Democratic left, people like Charles Blow, who appeared on the BNC, that's the Black News Channel. I'm not even familiar with the Black News Channel, I must tell you. But there he was, a New York Times commentator, Charles Blow, saying that this is yet another promise that Joe Biden has abandoned. Clip two.
There is a lesser touted provision in the bill, a $285 billion tax break for the country's upper middle class. In the most recent version of the bill, Democrats raised the amount of state and local taxes, also known as SALT, Americans can deduct on their federal income returns. High-income families will be able to increase their annual deduction from $10,000 a year to $80,000 a year through 2030. The move partially walks back a provision in Donald Trump's signature tax bill that caps SALT deductions and place an extra burden on wealthy taxpayers in highly taxed, largely blue states like New York and California. It's also the second most expensive provision in the bill, nearly $100 billion more than paid family and medical leave, which would get nixed again, probably by moderates in the Senate.
Okay, what he's talking about is basically a pure political maneuver. Obviously, the Democratic states, the most Democratic states, the wealthiest Democratic states, are the ones that charge the most in state and local taxes. I mean, I think what the California state income tax is like 13%. So if you can write that off your federal taxes, that's a huge giveaway, and it's not available to ordinary people, lower middle class people who basically are paying Social Security but are paying very little or nothing in their state or local taxes. And the idea with state taxes is we also have a number of states, including Washington State, including Florida, including Texas, where people don't pay state income taxes, so they don't get this kind of deduction at all. And this is a way of punishing states that are doing the right thing, which is lowering the tax burden on everybody within the state. Bernie Sanders even blasts his fellow Democrats on this issue. And listen to the senator from Vermont, clip one.
I think it's bad politics, it's bad policy. The Democrats correctly have campaigned on the understanding that amidst massive income and wealth inequality, we've got to demand that the wealthy start paying their fair share of taxes, not give them more tax breaks. The bottom line is we have to help the middle class, not the 1%.
Okay, that's a boilerplate from Bernie Sanders. Nancy Pelosi at her press briefing was trying to defend this massive tax cut for the mega rich in New York and California that she is fighting to impose. This is clip three.
Can you respond to the criticism that when all is said and done on this bill, the people who get the biggest tax cut are millionaires who can take advantage of the changes in the state and local tax deductions?
Thank you for that question. As a supporter of that particular measure in the bill, I want to just say and thank you for allowing me to clarify what that is about. That's not about tax cuts for wealthy people. It's about services for the American people. In our communities where we have taken care of our people, education, transportation, health care, all of the issues that public service brings to people was slashed by the Trump administration, and we're just turning that over. So this isn't about who gets the tax cut. It's about which states get the revenue that they need in order to meet the needs of the people. And that is a fight that I will continue to make.
That is still the result, though. I mean, that is still the result.
No, it isn't. It isn't the result. That isn't the result. The fact is that the dynamism that is injected into our states for the people is what is important here.
Okay, but then the dynamism that is injected into the states. In other words, that by favoring states that have high taxes, giving people who live there some kind of refund, no matter how much they earn. See, what they did is they preserved this in the Trump tax cut, which was actually the more you look at it, the more you see how reasonable and constructive that particular piece of legislation, which was largely drafted by Paul Ryan, miss him, that was a very good thing. Because, yes, they gave you a tax break if you paid, but it was capped. And it was capped at $10,000. So it could help some middle-class people who are hit by high state and local taxes, but it wouldn't necessarily apply to people who were earning a great deal more. That's extremely surprising to hear Democrats arguing about this. And again, the general expectation right now is that they're going to make a very visible effort to try to get through their budget-busting, buyback, build-back-better bill. They're going to make it look like they're trying really hard, but they know that Joe Manchin is going to kill it in the last analysis. Because he's already said there's more money there than he can go along with. So unless they find somebody, I have no idea who it would be. I can't imagine who it would be or should be. Unless they find somebody on the Republican side who decides to basically sell his soul to go along with this bill, it's not going to go through in this form. It's just too bloody expensive. It feeds inflation. And it endangers continued economic growth. When we come back, there's breaking news in the trial for the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, and some remarkable testimony by one of the defendants, Travis McMichael, the son, who actually got into a confrontation, pulled the trigger. The cross-examination went so well for Kyle Rittenhouse, they must have been watching, they decided, well, it's going to be a really good idea to put our defendant on the stand, too, and let the prosecution have at him, and he can explain why it was self-defense. Now they just tried the same thing with Travis McMichael and the killing of Ahmaud Arbery. How'd it go? Can you spell disaster? We will get to that coming up on The Medved Show.
The Michael Medved Show.
You can't handle the truth.
And we are now in the third day of jury deliberations in the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. Nobody has any idea what that means. Fascinatingly, there has been big new information, particularly having to do with the leg kick man that they had not identified, who is now identified, and whether this will impact the result of the trial. They clearly are trying to avoid a mistrial, which is a hung jury where they can't agree. And we will see. We will bring you the latest if the jury comes back with any final result, which should be soon. Meanwhile, in Georgia, there is the McMichael trial, the trial about the killers of Ahmaud Arbery, and they made a truly desperate effort and a desperate decision to try to put the principal defendant, Travis McMichael, on the stand. He's well-spoken, etc. The problem is he has no case to make. He's trying to suggest that he felt frightened about an unarmed man who was running away from him and chased him and then got into a confrontation over the gun that he, McMichael, was carrying. which he then fired into the victim, killing him. And here is what the cross-examination sounded like when the prosecutor questioned defendant Travis McMichael about this tragic killing. This is clip 12A.
Let's go ahead and start at the moment your dad kind of came running into the house. He was yelling for you, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
All right, he yelled that the guy from the other night was running down the road.
Yes.
And you understood that he was talking about the black man that you had seen go into the scene, the open, unsecured construction site 12 days beforehand on February 11th.
But he said the guy that had been breaking into the house just ran by. So, yes, that was what I was thinking at the time.
Okay. And your father ran into his bedroom to get his .357 Magnum revolver.
Yes, where it was, yes, ma'am.
Right. And I want to be real clear. He didn't say he'd seen the man breaking into the house.
No.
Just that he'd seen the man running down the street.
That has been breaking in the house, is what he said, yes, ma'am.
And you hadn't seen the black man in the 12 days between February 11th and February 23rd, had you?
I did not.
Okay, and then the story continues, and this is the dramatic and important part. Clip 12B.
I don't know what happened. I'm going to go down and investigate. It was.
So you're going to go down and investigate, even though you testified. You're not going to chase or investigate someone who is armed, correct?
I don't know if he was armed or not. I don't know if he was armed or not. Just go and look. I'm not going to just look at the totality of the circumstance. It's not stopping. To the point and say, are you armed? Or if he had a gun or anything, I would have backed off. I just wanted to go and see what's going on. That was all it was at that point.
You didn't tell your dad this is a really, really bad idea that could go really wrong for us and we should just stay here and call 911. You didn't say that, did you?
I didn't.
Now, when you got inside the truck, you had your phone with you.
Yeah. Yes, I had my phone.
And you didn't call 911 at that point?
I did not.
And you didn't give it to your dad to call 911 at that point?
No, because I thought that he has called 911 and he had his phone at the time.
Okay, and this, again, illustrates something we began the show talking about. A lesson from both of these trials. Do not take the law into your own hands. Again, if you have police in Kenosha who are putting their lives on the line. And I understand that, and he's made it very clear, this is the case, that Kyle Rittenhouse had wanted very much to protect property, to stand up against the riots. But to try to do that as a civilian is dangerous for everybody, for the community, for you, for the police, and of course for victims of shooting, even if they are rioters. To look who has suffered on this, aside from the people who were killed. To say that Kyle Rittenhouse hasn't had his life profoundly disrupted, of course he has and deserves to. And then Mr. McMichael explained further about the altercation between him and Arbery and how it actually started and what he felt at the time. This is clip 13.
Do you remember where your bodies were moving?
I know that he was, I didn't know where I was at, but I knew that he was on me. I knew that I was losing this. I knew that if I was getting tripped, if I would have tripped, or if he would have got a lucky strike on my head, or if I would have lost that grip on that shotgun, that I would have been shot or I'd have been in serious trouble at that point. I knew that he was overpowering me, but I didn't know which direction or what mechanics he was doing to overpower me.
At that time, did you remember how many times you shot the gun?
No, I didn't. I thought I shot twice.
But you shot it. You shot it.
Yes. Yes.
Do you remember how many times you did?
I thought it was twice until later on speaking with the investigator that I realized that it was three shots. But I shot the first shot, I knew I shot. And then the second shot, I shot again because I was still fighting. I was still He was all over me. He was still all over that shotgun, and he was not relenting. So I shot again to stop him. That third shot, which I thought was second, that final shot, he disengaged. And at that point, he let go. He turned and continued to run down Satilla. And at that point, I was in shock.
Okay. The story here and the essence of the problem with the defense that they're trying to make is that they were very clearly the aggressors here. This is not like the Kyle Rittenhouse thing one bit in that regard. They weren't trying to get away from Arbery. Arbery was trying to get away from them, and they trapped him between their pickup trucks. And they had a third guy who was filming the whole thing. So for goodness sake, if you suspect someone has been breaking into an empty house, it's not even your home. For you to take on a self-appointed police function and then to continue pursuing an individual, would it have been phenomenally different if the individual had been white? It may well have, because they wouldn't have suspected him so immediately or associated him with these break-ins at a construction site. But what a terrible thing when you think about the pain of the family that is mourning a young man who now has no chance to make a life for himself. And when you think of the pain of the McMichael family that is going to be dealing with very serious consequences, I think it is extremely likely that there will be, at the very least, a significant prison term for these individuals. And the point is, all from this refusal or this belief that society is so badly organized, is so much breaking apart, that you need to defend order on your own rather than relying on the means that we have to defend order. This is the problem with the whole broken windows effect, is that if you're living in a place and you get the idea that there basically is no one you can count on, no one you can call on, because things are chaotic, and there are homeless encampments and drug needles and paraphernalia scattered everywhere and broken windows and graffiti, that gives the idea to well-intentioned, decent citizens that I have to do this myself. And that, of course, only amplifies the chaos and means more danger for more people. Coming up on The Medved Show, we'll talk about why science has already selected the ultimate popular song, one that is particularly played and popular and has an almost mystical impact on listeners. What is it? It's not a song that you would necessarily suspect. And we'll also be talking about the latest on the Rittenhouse case and more in this greatest